And good afternoon. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and with me is Phil Conan. How you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon.
Today we're going to have two really interesting guests. We're going to be talking to David Hoyle. He's of the European Sudanese Public Affairs Council. The story of Sudan, the issue of its region, Darfur, is all over the papers. And there's every possible angle, so we need to talk to David Hoyle, who is well-informed. Yeah, there is a website, which, by the way, I noticed is down today, espac.org. We'll ask him about that, because if there's a time we need for him not to have his website down, it is now. And at the second, in the second half of the hour, we're going to talk to Professor Jose Maria Joma Sison, a well-known Philippine opposition leader who has been in exile in the Netherlands for at least 20 years, recently was charged with murder by the Dutch police, and that the case went before a Dutch court and was thrown out for lack of evidence, and there was, in the appeal court's decision, a suggestion that they thought politics might be a factor. Jose Maria Sison is the founding chairman of the Communist Party of the Philippines. He was the chief political consultant, is the chief political consultant of the National Democratic Front for the Philippines. There's a negotiating panel of which he is a, to which he is a consultant. And he is the chairperson of the International League of People's Struggle. So we'll be asking him not only about his case, but also what is the situation in the Philippines, what is going on with the regime there, and whether or not, also his charges that the United States has been involved in pushing for charges against him, as and that the Dutch government is also complicit. So that's of great interest to us. We want to ask him about all those things. But we're going to begin with David Hoyle. And by golly, he's on the line. Are you there, David?
Yes, indeed. Hello, Phil.
Hello. It's good to have you with us. You know, we haven't talked for a while, and my goodness, the information, all the stories regarding Sudan are just... I found that when I was going to make a list of questions, I thought, well, I'm going to have to give up here. I'm not going to be able to cover all the things I'm hearing about. But the big one I want to start with, because it's something that we want our listeners to know about, was this decision of the Advertising Standards Authority of Britain, which told the organization Save Darfur that they had to alter their... their language. They had made a claim on television that there were 400,000 deaths as a result of the fighting in Darfur, roughly, as my understanding of it. Now, you've taken a lot of grief in your years of struggle to get the facts out as you see them. You must be somewhat gratified at this development.
Well, I mean, one of the difficulties, which I think we've actually touched on a number of times, is that, I mean, essentially, Sudan is a fact-free zone. It's actually very difficult to get to the bottom of most facts in that country. And it's that's actually been exacerbated, of course, as much as a number of groups outside of Sudan have used facts and accuracy as a free fire zone. I mean, they've actually sort of embraced or used a number of assertions and allegations without... anyone really being able to call them to account or to in some cases even question them. So the adverts you mentioned by Saved Our Four were all part of, I think, a $30 or $40 million advertising campaign. Every single big newspaper in the States, every single broadsheet newspaper in Britain, and most of them in Europe, had at some stage in time, and on a number of occasions on a very, very regular basis, run adverts
yes,
which claimed, amongst other things, that 400,000 people had been killed in Darfur.
Remind me, I recall seeing that ad, seeing an ad, a very powerful one, running on CNN. Was that part of that campaign?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, For a while, it actually was impossible to take the subway in New York without coming across these adverts as well. You know, the media campaign using those sorts of claims was unprecedented. I mean, literally a $30 or $40 million campaign. So, the basic assertion in the of the ads were that 400,000 people had been killed in Darfur, and therefore we needed to intervene militarily. So that was the theory. Now, the European Citizens Public Affairs Council in Britain used a mechanism which exists only in Britain, in effect, which is that the advertising industry in Britain has a watchdog, actually called the Advertising Standards Authority, and we actually formally complained about one of the adverts as a specimen. And after, I think, 8 months of investigation, the ASA came down in favor of the complaint. They said, yes, your complaint has basis, and they've are now actually banned the Save.4 campaign from using that sort of language.
It's probably regrettable that they didn't have to also go on air and say, by the way, we misrepresented those numbers.
Well, I mean, the ASA handles adverts which appear in the print media, so it's only on magazines and newspapers. They've not actually run those sorts of adverts within the British TV channels or things like that. So the actual ASA adjudication only applied to news magazines and print media.
Yeah. I was speaking to David Hoyle of the European Sudanese Public Affairs Council, and David, your organization was not the only one concerned about this these inflated figures and the language, the use of the term genocide, for example, in Darfur.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think one of the sad facts is that the Save Darfur campaign in Washington, D.C. has managed to entrench itself very much within the body politic. Sudan has no friends in Washington, no one to actually argue the other side of the coin. So, in effect, groups like Save.4 have had an open goal for a number of years, and they've built up a very, very effective coalition around these sorts of questionable assertions. So, that's been one of the other big difficulties we've had on Darfur, and they've been able to influence a lot of American government policy.
Mm-hmm. That leads naturally to the latest visit to the region by this group called the Elders, and you pointed out to me the Christian Science Monitor carried quite a detailed and good account of their visit. I have to tell you that the reports here on television only told us that Jimmy Carter had an argument with an official at a refugee camp, and that they had not been polite to him, or he had not been polite to them, and this was somehow evidence, I think they wanted to suggest, of what a terrible regime the Khartoum was. But actually, the content of the visit and some of the political statements, particularly by Jimmy Carter, were rather helpful, I think.
Well, I think helpful, yes, because, I mean, going back onto your last point as well, the simple fact is most of the humanitarian aid groups who are present in Darfur and in Sudan are very, very uncomfortable with the sort of rhetoric and allegations coming out of groups like Save Darfur. A concept of a Western militant intervention in Darfur they see as being disastrous. The concept of a no-fly zone is not just unenforceable, but also disastrous in any instance. So I think that Jimmy Carter, when he was actually on the ground, and the comments he made about genocide actually not being present in Darfur, that other claims made by the Bush administration were actually unfounded. I think he also consciously or unconsciously expressed a number of the concerns which those NGOs have have raised, I think, informally over the years. I mean, he's actually very much in touch with the NGO community and aid workers in, you know, not just in Darfur, but across Africa. So I think, you know, that's a rather monumental observation that the whole basis of American foreign policy towards Darfur, that is to say that there's actually genocide happening, is actually without substance. And therefore, there will be other explanations for that policy position. I think that was an incredibly strong statement for him to make.
Yeah, and another thing, statement from Carter that was, I thought was helpful based on the work that we've done around this story here at CAUT, was that he said that there's been no critical scrutiny of the so-called rebel groups. He says, if you're going to talk about violations, or if you're going to even have successful peace talks, you have to include, when you discuss violence, you have to talk about them as well.
Well, I think, I mean, that's one of the sad things about this conflict also, is that given the leeway which groups like Save Darfur and the American administration have had in the sorts of claims they've made about Sudan and Darfur, I mean, events in Darfur, the rebels have actually been projected as being the guys who are wearing the white hats in this conflict, which is a very much, you know, not the case. I think anyone, you know, objectively approaching the issue will actually realize that there are no white hats in this conflict. Our governments and the rebels, you know, it's, you know, no one comes out of this well. And now it's a matter of actually just making sure that some sort of a peace mechanism is actually agreed and upheld within Darfur. The difficulty also we have with, I think, other rebels. The rebels are a bit like the vaudeville magician, which you used to have in seaside towns in Britain. The guy who would go into the audience and, you know, and take your watch and then wrap it up in a rag and then smash it with a hammer and then miraculously actually bring out an undamaged watch and give it back to you. This is so roughly what the rebels have done. They've actually gone into Darfur. They've actually been party to the smashing up of Darfur. But they've actually forgotten the rest of the trick, which is that once you've actually done that, once you've gone to war, at some stage in time, you have to actually negotiate a peace. Mm-hmm. Once you've actually been offered all the things you want to achieve, you then have to actually sit down and sign that peace agreement. They've actually forgotten the rest of the trick. They've gone to war, but they don't, you know, now know how to actually reach the end goal.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had an instance, and I wonder if you could comment on that. 10 peacekeepers were killed. The world now knows it was, this time there was no dispute. It was one of the rebel groups killed 10 peacekeepers. And then it was along the way in telling that story, the media mentioned that one of the sources of material and vehicles for the rebels is those poor peacekeepers who get them stolen. And I guess that's if right. They get in the way of having them stolen, they get killed. And yet, somehow or another, that didn't redound to the, you might say, to the positive side of the government's position, which is that these rebels are pretty wild characters. Instead, it got somehow interpreted here as, well, that just shows how the stubbornness of Khartoum has driven these people to desperate steps.
Well, one of the other very dangerous aspects of conflict in Darfur over the last 2 years or so is that the work done by the UN in terms of actually keeping, you know, 2 million people alive within Darfur has been first rate. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I have my doubts about aspects of the UN in general, but in this instance, the work they've done on the ground from a humanitarian point of view has been unbelievable. It's been outstanding. That entire very, very difficult and tenuous operation is actually threatened every single day by a daily attack on aid convoys and aid workers. The attacks, by and large, 80, 90% of these attacks are coming from rebels. or groups, you know, who began life as robots. And what these attacks have actually done is that basically closed down whole areas of Darfur to the aid workers and aid groups.
Mm-hmm.
So thereby actually threatening or endangering, you know, a large section of the population in Darfur.
Yes.
And these attacks are specifically to gain mobile phones, cell phones, satellite phones, vehicles, petrol, lubricant, water, and money.
Mm-hmm.
It's as simple as that.
Well, and by the way, and that takes us back to this original matter of the false claims about the number of lives lost. That an opinion piece was written in the New York Times by a man named Dealey, and he pointed out that the figures indicate that, yes, you have a certain loss of life, and it what they call excessive, that would be beyond the ordinary expected mortality rate. But he said that what is striking about the numbers is that 70% of those are from malnutrition and disease. And he says these are things which would be affected by the aid effort, which the rebels don't seem to be very interested in sustaining.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's also, of course, a school of thought which would point to the fact that a number of the attacks on aid workers, you know, have been done with malice aforethought, in the sense that, you know, the groups or the people who are doing it know full well that if you kill two or three or four Western aid workers, you will actually see the end of that aid operation in at least a large part of Darfur. So, you know, people know that this is the Achilles heel of the Western operation. And again, that school of thought would say, well, if we do that, then there'll be sort of more and more pressure on Sudan and on the government to do something. And then next thing you know, you have NATO or the British or the Americans intervening in Darfur, just as they did, of course, in Somalia in 91, which is almost the same analogy, because you had, you know, UN forces in Somalia. They kept on being attacked by militia, rebels, gunmen. Mm-hmm. And eventually, the call was then for Western forces to go in to actually sort out the Somalis, which, of course, never happened. In fact, the opposite happened.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very dangerous game, which I think is being played in Darfur.
Yeah, indeed, and it looks more dangerous almost by the hour, judging by what I find when I go on the Internet and pick up the stories. By the way, we're speaking to David Hoyle. He's from the European Sudanese Public Affairs Council. By the way, David, I have to tell you, I went to your site and it said it was being repaired. Is that a mistake? ESPAC.org?
It's not been repaired, no. We do occasionally update it.
So maybe somebody's repairing you.
That may well happen. I mean, we've had a large amount of internet attacks of that nature over mm-hmm. the years, so I'd not be surprised if we are mm-hmm. being targeted again.
But that is where people go, by the way. Just they should go to espac.org, right?
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Yeah. Now, there's these talks that are scheduled for Libya, which are really coming up soon. Is that what's causing this sudden flurry of strange declarations and things? I wonder if you would, I mean, if you speculate that way. For example, we understand the South Sudanese representative has been withdrawn from Khartoum, and there's going to be an issue about their border. As a matter of fact, I heard Jimmy Carter talking about that. This man, Omar Campo, who's the chief prosecutor at the new permanent tribunal in The Hague, he says that you can't have peace talks if that minister so-and-so is not arrested and delivered to me. And then we have Mr. Kushner of France saying that the European Union is going to send troops, several thousand. And some are saying, well, you know, France is awfully close to Chad. That might be a problem. But anyway, so all this is happening. And the Ethiopians, I understand, might be getting involved. But so Is this all because we're about to have some serious talks? Oh, I'm sorry. And all the rebel groups say they're going to fight each other now. I left that out.
Well, I think, I mean, the one hallmark of the last 18 years of the government in power at this moment in time in Khartoum is that it has been constantly under attack. I mean, under pressure, a military, economic, a diplomatic, or whatever. And one of the hallmarks, again, of that is that, you know, it's a government which has actually thrived, in a sense, on crisis. They seem to be quite a good crisis managers. Having mentioned that, though, I mean, there's a very much a unprecedented level of pressure on the government. The rebels, there are now 18, 19, more than 20 rebel factions out in the field in Darfur. So that all by itself is a problem which is almost impossible to actually.
That gives any external power who might want to cause mischief all kinds of room to do so, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And the point I make as well, this comes from a number of years of watching Sudan, is even if on Monday morning peace broke out in Darfur, you would have trouble actually breaking out again in another part of Sudan, the far north, which is even more marginalized in a sense than Western Sudan is, or again in the east, or the middle of the country. So, you know, unfortunately, there are countries and there are people and groups who seek the permanent destabilization of Sudan for whatever reason. And, if you want to make trouble in Africa, you have young people and lots of weapons. So it's not difficult, sadly.
It seems rather easy to arm a group without heart. It'd be very difficult to detect if you have multiple groups and spokespersons. You might. I don't know. Does Khartoum itself say? Sometimes governments prepare kind of an account of who they're fighting, and they say we've captured these weapons in the hands of this. Do you get that kind of report from them? Do they say they know where a weapon has come from, or know where this group is getting arms and that sort of thing?
Well, once again, I mean, they are their own worst enemies. I mean, they've been very, very lackadaisical in compiling information like that. I mean, there's no doubt, for example, that from time to time the government in Chad has backed the rebels. The Libyan government has backed the rebels. The people in Eritrea, government there, has also backed the rebels. The rebels in southern Sudan, the SPLA, at one stage in time also backed them, militarily as well as actually politically. So you've had a lot of weaponry and training being put into the rebel movements over the years by other countries. There's also, of course, you know, sort of a footprint, I think, of the United States as well.
Given their rhetoric, one would think so. I mean, the U.S. rhetoric has been just over the top. I think that, of course, that's one of the things he's trying to tell them, that if they're serious about talks, they shouldn't act
absolutely
the way they do, including Hillary Clinton, who's talking about shooting down Sudanese planes.
Absolutely. There comes a time, I mean, all wars, as we've discussed over the years, all wars actually bring with them propaganda. There's no doubt about that. And we now live in a media age where it's actually very easy to do propaganda exercises. The simple fact is, when you want to move towards a peace process, you have to actually start to deconstruct the propaganda. I mean, just as, you know, within the peace process or towards the peace process, you begin to, you know, lift landmines because, of course, they are an impediment to movement, you also have to begin to lift propaganda. And I see no sign of that, actually, from either Washington or any of the other groups who are out there advocating more and more military intervention. The irony is, and this actually is a verifiable fact, people like Alex Saval, who is one of the most reliable independent experts on Sudan, he makes the point that, you know, the war basically in Darfur ended in early 2004. You've had a number of instances of instability since then. The actual mortality rate in Darfur, he has said, is now probably lower than it was before the conflict began, you know, and that's a fact. So all these, you know,
that's Alex DeWall.
Alex DeWall, yeah.
Yeah, he has quite a reputation for he's widely respected.
Absolutely, absolutely. Of course, I mean, the fact is that, you know, and again, I mentioned this from time to time, there might be 100 or 200 people dying a month actually from violence related activities. And you can compare that with, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 per month in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Things have actually settled down in a sense in terms of the war. I mean, there are spikes of activity. But all this is endangered by the concept of actually bringing in a NATO force or a UN force, you know, mm-hmm. against the will of the government of Sudan. It'll be a magnet for any nationalist within Sudan, and of course any a jihadist from, you know, Algiers to Zanzibar would also actually move down to Darfur as a statement. So
I hear you say Zanzibar?
Well, yeah, I mean every crazy in North Africa,
yes,
would basically head towards Darfur as, you know, as an Iraq in the Sahel.
Yes. We're speaking to David Hoyle of the European Sudanese Public Affairs Council, ESPAC.org. I really suggest everyone go there to get background information. David, speaking of the sort of the original framing of this story and the issue of propaganda, it is repeated continually as if it were a fact that the source of the rebellion, it happened because out of frustration of people in the region, because they felt they were neglected. No other explanation for the violence of the armed groups was ever provided, but is it possible there are other explanations?
Well, I think there are many factors. I mean, in terms of being marginalized, as I mentioned just now, I mean, Western Sudan is no more marginalized than other parts of Sudan. At the far north, I've actually been to villages there which are far worse than parts of Darfur and so on. So, you know, that's not specific. I mean, it's a good a public relations issue to raise and say, well, you know, we are fighting because of this, that, or the other, including marginalization, but it's not strictly speaking the case. Also, what's happened, of course, is that one of the groups at the heart of the insurgency, at the heart of the movement, is the Fur group, the Fur tribe. You know, if you look at...
And that's a cross-border tribe. They also exist in Chad.
Well, they do. The interesting thing is, though, that, you know, far from being marginalized, the Fur were actually in charge of Darfur, you know, way into the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the governors of Darfur actually came from that tribe. They were the ones who were at the top of the pile in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, or for it now to be made out that the Fur somehow are marginalized and, you know, haven't been having their share of power in Darfur is nonsense. So, but nonetheless, these are easy sound bites. And
in following it, you know, it just seems to me that media ought not to just repeat like a mantra rather than to look into, well, who are they and is it true even? I mean, and to consider perhaps counter theses, because I assume that the government of Khartoum and some of its representatives, who you say are actually from the region, would probably say, no, that isn't so.
Well, that's right. But again, as you know, I mean, all too often looking at the media, I think, in North America, the media has a very, very short attention span. And once something appears on paper and is actually filed, you know, it's almost impossible to break free of how things have been framed in that sense. And
well,
many of the images and sound bites on Darfur actually continue to this day.
Yeah. Well, I congratulate you on your part in this. I think that the success with the advertising authority sort of put everybody on notice. They ought to be a little more careful about what they say and also what people just take from a newspaper and believe. It's good work.
Well, thank you so much.
And
thanks,
David, thanks very much for being with us. And given all these things are going on, I hope we can speak to you again sometime soon to find out what's going on with the talks.
Anytime.
Thank you very much, David Hoyle.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was David Hoyle of the European Sudanese Public Affairs Council. You can go to espac.org and learn more. There's a great, on that site, you'll find a terrific discussion of Bill Clinton's role in attacking Khartoum. Well documented, a great discussion. The United States has never apologized, never paid a cent for damages, and they smeared the Sudanese government saying they had attacked a biological weapons site. But it all turned out to be baloney. I mean, and they never made a case. And the man who owned the medical facility brought a lawsuit against him. I hope he won. You're listening to the Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM. We'll take a brief break, and we will be back and be speaking, we hope, with Professor Jose Maria Sison in the Netherlands. And we're back. It's Taylor Report, CAT, 9.5 FM. I think, Phil, you have some announcements here.
Yes, we have an announcement from the Toronto Haiti Action Committee. They're having an event on Sunday, October the 28th. This is giving you lots of notice here. It's a report back from a recent human rights investigative delegation to Haiti with Roger Annis and B.C. Holmes. That'll be at the Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street, Sunday, October 28th at 1 p.m. Admission free. Donations are welcome. For more information, go to thac.ca. That's Toronto Haiti Action Committee, thac.ca. And their phone number is 416-713-2325. And again, Sunday, October 28th, 1 p.m., Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street, the Toronto Haiti Action Committee, with a report of a delegation. And the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid will have two film showings, one on Tuesday, October 23rd, Massacre. This is the second showing of this film, which sold out last time. And on Tuesday, October the 3rd, Gold Dreams, Journeys of the Palestinian National Soccer Team. Go to brunswicktheatre.ca to order tickets, or go to the Toronto Women's Bookstore in person at 73 Harbour Street. And was there a website for CAIA? I didn't see one on here. Here it is, www.caiaweb.org, caiaweb.org, for the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid. Again, their films are on October 23rd and October 30th, $5 students, $10 seniors at 296 Brunswick Avenue, and they're urging you to buy your tickets in advance because they're anticipating sellouts.
Very good. Thanks an awful lot. And joining us now, I believe, is Professor Jose Maria Sison. He is the founding chairman of the Communist Party of the Philippines. He is the chief political consultant of the National Democratic Front of the Philippines and chairperson of the International League of People's Struggle. Are you there, Professor? Hello?
Hello. The voice level is quite low, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, a bit better.
Well, I'll do my best. first of all, you've been in a very, I guess, well, you must be in good spirits. So you have had an important court victory in the Netherlands court, where an attempt by the Dutch police to bring charges against you of murder and for murders that took place, I understand, in the Philippines. But the appeals court in the Netherlands has turned them down, and it, of course, also led to your release. My understanding is that the appeal court that turned this matter back to the prosecutor said that they thought that perhaps, and I notice I use the word perhaps, politics was involved. Could you tell us about, first of all, why you believe that you were successful in court, and what the politics might be that are behind this?
I've been quite successful in court here in the Netherlands because, in the first place, the charge against me is false and obviously politically motivated. So I won before the District Court of The Hague and then before the Court of Appeals in quick succession. The courts declared that there is no direct and sufficient evidence against me, and the Court of Appeals, in making its decision October the 3rd, said that there is a political context of the charge, indicating that there is the political motivation, and also spelling out that the witnesses against me are polluted, are cannot be relied upon. Mm-hmm. And the court victories that I have in the Netherlands have been preceded by victories in the Philippines, as well as in the European Court of First Instance. You see, I won the case before the Supreme Court involving a charge of rebellion, which covered 1968 to 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And the incidents involved in the false charge against me in the Netherlands, two incidents involving the killing of two military agents of the Philippine government were wastebasketed mm-hmm. by the Supreme Court decision. And so the incidents were merely recycled. The Dutch government was made a fool by the Philippine government supplying the charge and providing witnesses. And then the Philippine government failed to inform the Dutch government that the same incidents ascribed to me had been nullified before the Supreme Court mm-hmm. in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the victory I won in before the European Court of First Instance involved the terrorist blacklist. So the court decided that I should be removed from the blacklist.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose three governments, the U.S., the Dutch, and the Philippine governments, have been reacting to my to my court victories in Europe and the Philippines. And so there is this false charge against me involving alleges that I have ordered or incited the killing of two military agents.
Mm-hmm. There's a second issue, I think, involved with your charges that I wonder to what extent you think this might have been part of the motive. I understand that when they took you into custody, which they did it somewhat on false pretenses. They said they wanted to talk to you, but then they took you into custody. Offices of organizations that you have worked with or do work with, I guess it's a National Democratic Front for the Philippines. Their offices
could you repeat
were...
the question? The voice level is quite low, and my
I'll do my best.
Reception is quite poor.
I wonder. Do you think that they do you think they wanted to get into the offices of the Philippine organizations there that you work with? Because their materials were taken, computers, documents.
Oh yes, the office of the National Democratic Front Information office was raided, and six. Homes of panelists, consultants, and staffers of the negotiating panel of the National Democratic Front of the Philippines have been raided. And we presume that the false charge against me has been used as a pretext for further fishing expedition.
Mm-hmm.
So the basis of the charge of inciting murder is quite flimsy,
mm-hmm.
and because it is in the first place false, but it has been used as a pretext for the raids, and The expedition involves, getting hard copies, digital files, computers, hard disks, cameras, and so on from those places that have been raided. So there is an attack on the National Democratic Front of the Philippines. It's something I never done against the PLO or the African National Congress. This is unprecedented, and this is a manifestation of a global condition in which the Bush global war of terror has really spread, and there is the possibility that the initial attack on me could be the prelude to a bigger attack against the National Democratic Front of the Philippines. The three governments are practically ganging up on me, and each has its own motivation, as well as all three have common motivations. So they are out to fish for evidence which would substantiate this long unsubstantiated charge of terrorism against the Communist Party of the Philippines and the New People's Army and and myself as the chief political consultant of the National Democratic Front of the Philippines in its peace negotiations with the Manila government. And of course the very particular, very specific to the Manila government or the Arroyo regime, is its determination to suppress its political opponents. And then, of course, the Dutch government has been smarting from its defeat together with the European, together with the Council of the European Union before the European Court of First Instance, which decided against the blacklisting done initially by the Dutch government in Europe and then followed up by the Council of the European Union. So there is a wide range of motivations involved in these political attacks on the panelists, consultants, and staffers of the National Democratic Front of the Philippines. Yes.
But by the way, Professor Sisson, and by the way, I think I should say Joma Sisson, shouldn't I? People know you very much as Joma.
Yes, it's a contraction of Jose Maria,
yeah.
Joma. And the military is trying to ban, misrepresent it as a some kind of alias.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, you must be heartened. The fact that the court would say, no, we're not going to let you do that, and then also the European court that you referred to, it indicates there is some perhaps resistance in some European capitals to Bush's drive to sort of turn everybody to criminalize politics, you might say. Do you think that's possible?
Will you repeat your question?
Is it possible that there are those, that these court decisions are an indication of a will to resist, political will in Europe, some of Bush's diktat?
Oh, yes. There is a long line of persecution against me initiated by the executive branch of the Dutch government. And, the executive offices of the Manila government and the U.S. government have been conniving with the executive in the Netherlands, first against my application for political asylum here, and then they collaborated again in the blacklisting, in the terrorist blacklisting after 9/11 in 2002, specifically against me. But, there is a significant vestige of a sense of justice, of a sense of fair play. So when the cases are presented before the court, somehow the facts and the arguments prevail in my favor. So I think, just as in the United States, there is a growing resistance to the Bush regime messing up with the legal system, I suppose that here in Europe, there is a reservoir of good sense and goodwill among judges, and of course, the pressure comes from the people. They know how wrong the executive can be in the pursuit of this so-called global war on terror, which is actually a global war of terror involving the spread of fascization on a global scale and wars of aggression. And I'm very happy, and I'm very thankful to the organizations, individuals, and broad masses of the people all over the world who protested the false charge against me, my solitary confinement, and so on. I thank them for demanding my release, and I suppose the worldwide public opinion in my favor somehow inspired the judges to have more sense, even as they have already some amount of sense to start with. Against abuses, the tendency to violate human rights on the part of those who are in the executive branch of the government.
By the way, I'll tell our listeners, we are speaking to Professor Jose Maria Joma Sisan. He's in the Netherlands, and if you want to access information about this case and also the views of Professor, regarding the Philippines and other issues, you can go to Jose Maria Sisan .org. Am I right?
Yes, Jose Maria Sisan in one word and .org.
.org. And let's ask.
I would appreciate the people of Canada if they could visit the website and learn more about my case.
Yes, and let me ask you about that the situation. What is your reading of the situation today in the Philippines? Is there something taking place there that has caused them, for example, to be more severe towards yourself and to push the Dutch government to take these steps? What is the present situation in your view?
Only a few days ago, Senator Maria Ana Madrigal was with us. She visited us, and a joint statement was made between the National Democratic Front of the Philippines negotiating panel and her as chairperson of the Philippine Senate Committee on Peace. So there is a common view that the crisis in the Philippines, the economic, political, social, and moral crisis is worsening. And Senator Madrigal said that it is possible for Gloria Macapagal Arroyo to be thrown out of office before 2010. And so the people are supposed to be seething with anger at so much corruption, human rights violations, and subservience to foreign interest. And so she says that the broad masses of the people are could explode into huge demonstrations. And 80% of the military officers and men and women are supposed to be against Arroyo now. The anti-Arroyo groups within the military and police are prevailing over the pro-Arroyo groups in the chain of command. And so one more significant thing, the most active officers, including those who are now in prison, are willing to let civilian leaders assume the leadership in case it's possible to remove Arroyo. It's possible to have a council of leadership that is entirely civilian. The military officers that are anti-Arroyo are pledging to simply support a civilian council of leadership, and they say that they're not interested at all in having any share of power. So according to Senator Madrigal, this is the conditions now are far better than before for removing the Macapagal Arroyo clique from power.
Mm-hmm. Professor Sisan, you've said, and I think it's almost proverbial, that one of the most significant problem of the Philippines has always been subservience to Washington, and here there's the impression that the U.S. has reduced its role, its profile, and indeed its military presence. There remains U.S. military presence in the Philippines. Am I right?
Yes, as a consequence of 9/11, and as a consequence of the peculiar subservient character of the Arroyo regime, so the United States has been able to increase its presence in the Philippines. Of course, the U.S. tries to play cheapskate. It tries to it tries to have a minimal amount of facilities of its own, and then it depends on the facilities of the armed forces of the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And so thousands of troops are already in the Philippines, troops from the United States, in the name of joint military exercises and going after the Abu Sayyaf, which is a very small bandit group. Mm-hmm. And
yet they don't succeed.
The U.S. military intervention is increasing. Right now, there are talks that the U.S. Will fortify the Philippines as some kind of a forward position undertaking military actions in different parts of the world, and the U.S. is confident of gaining more control over the Philippines militarily because of the desperate situation in the Philippines. The Arroyo regime wants the military aid, and then it has the illusion that it can keep on auctioning off the natural resources of the country, the mineral resources, and the land. And these are supposed to answer for increasing amounts of foreign indebtedness. So there is this over-dependence on foreign investments and loans, especially from the U.S., and of course, the U.S. is in tandem with China in trying to exploit the Philippine situation. So you have big deals either initiated by American agents as well as Chinese agents in business. Sometimes they connive, sometimes they compete.
Mm-hmm.
So they are taking advantage of a prostrate economy in the Philippines.
By the way, we have in this country thousands of expatriates, Filipinos, who have and many, and this seems to be almost a global story of exported labor. What is your comment about that? The situation of Philippine expatriates.
You see, there is lack of economic opportunity, lack of employment for the common people. So you have a big diaspora of people. So 10% of the Filipinos are out of the country. And in fact, the remittances of overseas contract workers from the Philippines constitutes the biggest amount of resource for the Philippines to answer for, you know, consumption-oriented importations. So it's now the income of the overseas contract workers, which is answering for a great deal of the importations in the Philippines, and paying off parts of the foreign debt. So that's how big a factor now this exodus of surplus labor from the Philippines. And
many of them are,
you see Filipinos all over the world accepting low standards of compensation and lack of rights, especially in comparison to the workers in the host countries.
Yes, particularly in the Middle East, we in the Gulf states we hear terrible stories, brutal stories of what happens to has happened to Philippine workers. Professor Sison, I wonder lastly if we could just ask, I think our listeners like to know your opinion, what happened to the, what was the Aquino, so-called Aquino Revolution? What happened to that?
The Aquino Revolution?
So-called.
So-called, yeah. It was nothing.
I said that in italics.
There was a shift from one big comprador, landlord, politician like Marcos to another big comprador, landlord, politician called Aquino. And so, of course, for a while there was some difference. You had an out-and-out fascist dictatorship that made the Philippines more bankrupt, and then you have a new government that tried to undertake what was called low-intensity democracy, going with low intensity conflict strategy instigated by the U.S.
Yeah.
So repression never left the Philippines. It was merely moderated for some time and then camouflaged when it became more severe, even under the Aquino dispensation. And, well, I think so long as the Philippines does not rise from the level of semi-colonial and semi-feudal oppression and exploitation, I think there will be fluctuations in the severity of exploitation as well as state terrorism. And the fundamentals of the Philippine society involve foreign and feudal and bureaucratic exploitation, and this system of exploitation has to be maintained by increasing levels of force in correspondence to the rising levels of popular opposition.
Well, on that note, Professor, we're going to have to close, but we really appreciate you being our guest. Congratulations on your legal victory, and we hope we can talk to you again soon.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to your program.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Professor Jose Maria Joma Sison. He's the chairperson of the International League of People's Struggle. And this is Ben the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Thanks, Joe Conan. We'll be with you next week.